Week 5 of the war. The world is growing impatient, growing calls for a ceasefire or a humanitarian pause. Israel concerned this will allow Hamas to regroup. And we want to talk about the social media war waged alongside the war in Gaza. Why does it seem that Israel is losing that war? We will have Kara Swisher on to discuss. It's Unholy. I'm Yunit Levy of Channel 12 in Tel Aviv.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian in London. Unholy, two Jews on the news from Keshet Podcasts. As you say, week 5, it all feels actually like one long week or one blur.
One long day, really.
One long day. It hasn't stopped. It is sort of relentless. A milestone of sorts passed this week with the figure, and I know it's a contested one because it comes from the Gaza Health Ministry, which we and others point out is controlled by Hamas, but a figure of 10,000 dead in Gaza. And it is obviously a terrible number, a huge and tragic figure. And I have noticed that even people outside Israel who are sympathetic to Israel's predicament and believe that after the atrocities of the 7th of October, Israel has to hit back, it has to eradicate Hamas as a fighting force. This figure and the speed with which it's happened, people are really struggling with it. And that's why there's so much sympathy for these calls for a ceasefire and so on. And for example, one thing people say is, look, we get that you're in a position like when the Allies were fighting, United States and UK were fighting Islamic State, and in Mosul, they killed 9,000 to 10,000 civilians by some estimates. But that was over 9 months. The idea that this number, involving a huge number of children, images of body bags and so on, and grieving families, has arisen after just 4 weeks or 5 weeks of fighting or of Israeli military operations. It's very, very hard. Like I say, even for people who are predisposed to be sympathetic, it's just a very, very big number. And obviously behind that number is a whole lot of tragic stories. So I think that's where people find themselves at this point in the war. We talked before all about the humanitarian aid and the crisis of that. Now it's this big number staring at them.
Yeah, well, look, first of all, when you listen to what Secretary of State Blinken was saying in Japan, I think that what Israel is discerning, obviously from other conversations as well, is that the United States will give Israel a few more weeks, and after that will expect the IDF to tone down the military incursion and then only, if it's an only, but only raids into Gaza periodically. And of course, Israel is very concerned. The discussion, the specific discussion right now is about a humanitarian pause, meaning very brief ceasefire meant to, on the one hand, facilitate a release of some Israeli hostages. The concern in Israel is, of course, which has already experienced this from Hamas in 2014, when you have this kind of ceasefire, Hamas actually just regroups and leads another deathly charge against Israel. So that is what is on right now. What is the discussion? Hamas demands 4 days of this kind of pause. Israel is only willing to give 1 day. We will have to see how this plays out. But I think, Jonathan, you sort of pointed to the death toll in Gaza. And I think that is what is at the heart of this discussion. Because the more the numbers are high, the more the United States, or at least parts of, particularly the Democratic Party, are impatient with the president and his wholehearted support of Israel. I think Israel is in a tough spot. Now, I do want to focus on that a little bit. You already mentioned that the fact that we are getting these this information from Hamas, and also the fact that we don't exactly know. Israel has an estimate, but it doesn't exactly know how many of the dead are indeed terrorists. It is, I'm not trying to circumvent the problem and the question. It is obvious that there are civilian casualties. This is a terrible tragedy and a terrible reality of war. By the way, in modern warfare, in urban areas, 90% of casualties are civilians. That's a terrible statistic, but that is the truth. And this is an asymmetric war, because when you think of one side that does adhere to international law and the other side that clearly doesn't. And I want to say something about the trap that Hamas is laying in front of Israel after perpetrating this massacre against Israeli civilians, now clearly hiding behind its own civilians. Now, what is Israel supposed to do? Not hit military targets and thus not achieve the objective of hurting Hamas in a way that it can't perpetrate this kind of massacre again, or hurting these targets and then mounting pressure against Israel to stop. I think specifically the people who are concerned about civilian casualties, and by the way, so is Israel, because Israel has a whole unit in the IDF dedicated to international law and adhering to international law. Anyone concerned about this would actually say Israel should act patiently and with moderation. That is important. And sitting with the stopwatch that Israel always has, the international community always gives Israel, is a little bit of the opposite of that. If you give Israel the time to do this methodically, carefully, and actually achieve the objective of eradicating Hamas, then I think that it can be as careful as possible. But if you hide among civilians, if you do everything you can that the war zone will endanger your own civilians, I mean Hamas and the Palestinians, it's a very, very difficult situation.
Yeah, it is. I think the asymmetry is the key point I would pick up on there, is that you are against an enemy who, all the things we know, I mean, the where they fire rockets from schools and mosques and elsewhere. There was a group of Israeli and international journalists who were taken into Gaza last weekend, embedded with the IDF, I think really just for a few hours, but in the course of their time there, witnessed at one point IDF firing in the direction of a school and a mosque because rockets had fired at them from those places. And so that is an aspect of this that you know need to remember. There's also this claim from the IDF that the Hamas headquarters, almost like a military command, is underneath the Al-Shifa hospital. I mean, it is an exquisite sort of moral dilemma that is put in front of the IDF, which is, if rockets are coming at you from a target that is civilian, what are you exactly meant to do if you are defending yourself? And so that's the dilemma. I think from Hamas's point of view, it is a win-win, because either Israel says, we can't hit back at a hospital, we are going to leave this claimed command post, I'm only saying claim because I don't know myself, there. That's a win for Hamas. And if they then hit it and kill lots of civilians who are on the world's television screens, that's also a win for Hamas. I mean, the idea that Hamas, that I think is not factored in by enough observers of this, is that Hamas is not a conventional enemy in the sense of wanting to protect its own people. It doesn't want to do that. And that's why right at the start of this, you know, in the first piece I wrote on this, I said, Hamas is not the Palestinian cause. It is a curse on the Palestinian cause, because they do have this view, and we've seen it in some of those clips that have gone around the world, in which leaders of Hamas sitting outside Gaza in reportedly five-star accommodation in, you know, Doha and elsewhere, say, we are very ready to sacrifice martyrs. You know, we're very ready to sacrifice other people. So that puts a different gloss on it.
This is a different kind of war than we had last time. Right now, the military objective is to eradicate Hamas or to prevent it from having any sort of military power. It's a different objective. This is important because under international law, when you talk about proportionality, you mean that the cost of human life should not be excessive in relation to the a military advantage, a military objective. So if the military objective this time around is different, and indeed it is a larger and a bigger military objective, that relates to what this, I'm sorry to sound so cold in calculating this, but it is important to understand. By the way, everyone talks about this is what you should be doing, from Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders and beyond, right? That this, we need to fight Hamas. Even Bernie Sanders is saying, don't give them a ceasefire, they will amass more weapons. So again, if you define the objective like that, that is what you have to discuss when you discuss civilian casualties. I'm not saying it's an easy dilemma. I think it's an incredibly difficult one. And as you said, Hamas is just winning more. And the more the international community is pressuring Israel, I'm sorry to say this as bluntly, but this is galvanizing Hamas. It convinces them that they're the right, that it's the right tactic to use humans as a protective shield. And you saw in week 5 of this huge procession moving down from north to south, because they have finally realize that as much as Hamas is threatening them not to move, they have to do it to save their lives. And by the way, the idea for protecting that procession, moving to the southern point of the Gaza Strip. Just one more point about this discussion, because when you zoom out, there is a lingering suspicion, please correct me if I'm wrong about this, that it's not only the discussion relating to the number of casualties or the destruction in Gaza. Otherwise, we would have seen vast demonstrations, you know, after the wars in Syria or Iraq or Yemen or Libya or ISIS. I'm not sure it only has to do with what is happening in Gaza. I think it also has to do with who's sitting on the other side of the border. It kind of feels like the world is saying to Israel, you can defend yourself and eradicate Hamas as long as you don't eradicate Hamas and don't defend yourself. That is what it feels like, again, to Israelis sitting and looking at these at this criticism.
Yeah, no, I don't doubt it looks like that. I think from inside Israel, the inconsistency point is made, you know, strongly here too, you know, particularly Jewish communities do feel that there's a double standard applied to Israel.
You know, that is what we are seeing. Again, I think it would be very helpful for Israel to try and convince the world of giving, sadly, being in the situation where you need to convince the world to give you a little bit more legitimacy and a little bit more time. I do think the time here is important. I also think that it would be really helpful if some of the Israeli ministers, as we saw this week, would maybe talk less, because that isn't very, very helpful in what they are saying. You know, when people of me, like me, are saying on this podcast, just judge Israel by what it's doing, what it's saying. But still, you have certain detrimental, let's say, claims by some of the ministers, not helpful this week.
And here you have in mind the, I think, fairly junior minister who said, mm-hmm. you know, let's drop the atom bomb on Gaza.
To be accurate, he said it's an option. But I mean, I can't stress enough how much, as you called him a junior minister, he is unimportant in the Israeli government that has 38 ministries. And you kind of feel like saying, to quote a series that I love and a character I love, your mouth is open, words are coming out. That's never a good thing. In this case, again, not an important minister, but the damage that can be created by saying that kind of thing in the middle of a war is not, you know, this isn't helpful.
No, I agree. And the other point I would say that, and maybe this needs to come, maybe this can't ever come, but the rhetoric from, you know, more major figures in the Israeli government that would say, in a way, on the lines you have, which is that this is necessary, but it's painful to do this, that this is, you know, if an Israeli prime minister, if Netanyahu said, as far as we're concerned, this is a necessary evil. This is necessary because Israel has to eradicate Hamas. But we recognize the horror of it, and we don't take that lightly. I know that obviously many Israelis do say that, but I'm not sure they say it at the highest level, and I'm not sure they say it in a way that is heard by people around the world. There could be more of that. Now, I know a lot of people would dismiss that, you know, the old line about Israelis shooting and crying kind of thing. There are plenty of, I think, you know, Jewish voices around the world would are saying it, and I think it would be helpful for them, and also it would be helpful for people to understand Israel better if that case was put. I think some of the spokespeople for the Israeli government sounding instead quite sort of bullish and bellicose and sort of tough, rather than, there's a different tone you could adopt, which is mm-hmm. One that does see the sorrow and understands why viewers around the world are heartbroken by what they're seeing. I don't think Israel is conveying that at the moment, and I don't think it would hurt its case. I think it would strengthen its case if it did acknowledge that. For the whole 5 weeks of this war, you and I have been talking about how it is playing out, how it's affecting Jews in the diaspora, and the sense that there is less understanding, not only of Israel, but really of what it is to be Jewish. In that context, I mean, the story that broke this week would have been news anyway, but I think it landed with extra heaviness this week, which is a German kindergarten saying it was going to drop Anne Frank from its name in order to have a more diverse alternative. More diverse in quotes. It's a kindergarten in a village in East Germany. said it's now going to be rebranding itself the World Explorer Kindergarten in order to be more inclusive. I mean, that was always going to be hurtful. It was going to be hurtful, especially this week. It's the 85th anniversary of Kristallnacht, so memories of the Holocaust are in people's minds anyway. But it went to something deeper, which is this idea that, well, I would say two things that are conveyed in this move that are frightening. One is, in this current climate, we no longer think of Jews as a group who are, you know, what does it mean by the word diverse, that are sort of captured by the coalition of categories of people we think we should protect and defend. You don't count as one of those minorities whose side we would want to be on. So you're out. And that is particularly sharp now because people feel, Jews feel, that there is no sympathy, no benefit of the doubt granted to Israel, insufficient sympathy for what happened on October the 7th. But also a sense that a window is closing, that there was a period after 1945, after the Holocaust, in which, you know, Jews were accepted and that anti-Semitism was seen universally as a terribly evil thing. Therefore, in the first years of Israel, Israel was granted a kind of place in the family of nations and so on. And that time has run out. That 80-year chapter is closing. The sympathy that the world granted, and particularly a country like Germany granted, well, that's over now. You're no longer in the circle of the good. You know, Anne Frank, Holocaust victims, for 80 years, we thought of you as part of the group of people that we would want to identify with, no longer.
You know, you can't not think of Dara Horn's book published last year, People Love Dead Jews. The first story there is, in fact, about the Anne Frank Museum in Amsterdam, and one of the workers there had a kippah on, and they told him to hide it so as not to insult people, which is unbelievable when you think of the fact that someone had to hide his, you know, Jewishness in the Anne Frank Museum. But this is a continuation of the same thing. And as you say, happening now in the middle of a war that Israel is fighting and in the middle of this anti-Semitic wave washing Europe and the United States, it's just so, is really hurtful.
I remember the Dara Horn story. It was sort of that him wearing a kippah was compromising the universality of the message. We want the message to be exactly universal. And this is the interesting thing. And I think there's the same thing going on with this kindergarten idea that if Jewish isn't universal, other minorities, that's universal. But if it's Jewish, and then also that idea, which she talked about, didn't she, which was that, you can talk about the Holocaust so long as it is only about man's inhumanity to man. Right. If you bring out the Jewish aspect of it, no thank you. Right. So this,
and sadly, as
it does,
you said,
it lands especially now.
And as you said, we have discovered in the recent couple of weeks that people don't even love dead Jews. That is the sad reality of what we have discovered. We should also add, by the way, just on the sort of dangers for Jews around the world, first of all, that the Mossad thwarted an attack planned by Hezbollah against Jews in Brazil. Two Brazilian citizens were arrested for planning this attack. So it does say something that the Jewish community around the world is on high alert everywhere and for a very good reason.
And there are fears of this kind of threat to Jews all over the world, actually. In California, last weekend, a 69-year-old Jewish man died from his injuries after he had been struck by a pro-Palestinian protester at a rally in the town of Westlake or suburb of Westlake. It seems as if this protester was carrying, waving an Israeli flag. There's a picture of him just 5 minutes before he was struck. The claim is that he was struck by one of the pro-Palestinian protesters who was carrying a megaphone and that he died from his injuries shortly afterwards. Quite a lot of this is contested about exactly how the argument or row or violence broke out. But the result was an old man was pushed to the floor and he suffered head injuries and he died from that later. And the police are treating it as homicide. You take that there in California, right on the other side of the world, in Dagestan, that event we talked about on the podcast at the time, where there was a kind of hunting for Jews in the airport in Dagestan, led in turn, I'm told, has led to a great degree of anxiety and fear in the Moscow Jewish community that feels something has changed in their mood. They previously had felt as if there was a lid being kept on anti-Semitism, now not nearly so sure. And so, you know, you've mentioned Brazil. I mean, it is all over the Jewish world. There are this degree of fear and anxiety. You know, some of the groups who really follow this full time are urging caution and calm, saying it's bad, but we've got to keep things in some kind of sense of proportion. But it's very difficult when people are feeling this fearful.
Yeah. By the way, I heard a friend of and an avid listener of the pod who lives in Beverly Hills told me about, you know, Beverly Hills Park and spray paint, kill the Jews. And you've seen in Europe and the United States instances of houses being marked. And this is a very, very scary period.
Yeah, I mean, graffiti also on the Wiener Library here in London, which has an extraordinary and very resonant history. The Wiener Library was compiled by Alfred Wiener ahead of the war. He was a German Jew who realized that fascism was coming and on the march and gathered evidence of anti-Semitism and, in effect, the Holocaust as it was happening. The archive was originally in Germany. It moved to London, and then anti-Israel graffiti sprayed on that building. So all of these elements coming together in this week where the anniversary of Kristallnacht, there is a level of Jewish anxiety out there. There are voices, I would say I'm one of them, trying to say we need to keep this in proportion. We've got to, you know, try and do our best to sort of keep calm in the face of these things. But is there is great fear around is undeniable.
Yes, so the Jewish community feeling trepidatious around the world is very understandable. But this also speaks to a larger point, which is this war is not just being waged between Hamas and Israel. It is a larger war and has different aspects. One of those aspects is the social media aspect, and that is what we want to talk about with our very special guest.
There are a few people better placed to discuss the new battlefront, if you like, the information war played out on social media than our special guest this week. I think she is rated almost universally as the number one tech journalist in the world. She is the host of the podcasts Pivot and On with Kara Swisher. Kara Swisher, terrific to have you back on Unholy.
Glad to be back.
I mean, so much going on in just regular media and the regular information space, but people have really observed that this argument about the war is being fought out, particularly on social media, and they zero in especially on TikTok, and lots of numbers have come out. Because there will be some people listening to this who are not particularly across what happens on TikTok. Why has that become such a particular place?
Well, it's the most popular. That's why. I mean, obviously, young people aren't on Twitter, for example. And it's also a toxic waste dump more and more. And so it's not a particularly useful way to get media right now. And everybody sees it pretty clearly, even people who use it regularly. The TikTok's been a place where there's been a lot of activity. And so it's biggest and it's most popular, and therefore that's where propaganda would go necessarily. I don't think it's unusual that that would be the thing because it's a propaganda war. And they call it misinformation or disinformation, or this is an information war, but every war is an information war, you know, since the beginning of time. It just depends on what the tools are. In this case, they're all kinds of videos or online different online social media tools. And so TikTok's been the focus. I think, you know, a lot of people in the U.S. have pointed to it, especially anti-China people. But they've been removing videos. They just put out something. They removed about 725,000 videos from the region. They're trying to zero in on fakes. It removed a million pieces of content globally, and millions of pieces, of content globally. And so they have a really hard time taking things off because they're the biggest, essentially, and that's what people are using to do so. And of course, they're also caught up in, is the Chinese Communist Party trying to manipulate this conflict? And of course, they have to carry that around with them, whether it's true or not. It hasn't been proven, but most people feel like the Chinese Communist Party are using TikTok to influence the war.
So that's, I mean, I'm putting China and the influence just aside for a moment, but I mean, the data here is that when you look at the hashtag, you know, as of the end of October, you look at the hashtag Stand With Israel, 324 million times, Stand With Palestine, 3.4 billion times. That's 10 times more. Is that Internationally.
I believe that was from one of the committees in the U.S. that put that out. And so it's that they are pushing back on that. They say that is not the case, that Israel, the hashtags around Israel are more popular. And so it's, you know, this is an information war, but people are there's obviously a huge surge of this, right? And each side is going to use it.
And but I guess and what I'm asking is there malintent here, or is just the algorithm here just... That's how it is. There are more general. I mean, it sounds like superficial. There are more Muslims than there are Jews, and that's the case.
If those statistics are accurate, that's the problem. Is a lot of these people are putting out numbers that are not accurate necessarily, and that's also the point to confuse things. You know, they keep removing content. That's for sure. They're taking stuff out, especially a synthetic media. They call it, which is. You know, misleading. That's you know, using AI or other methods to make things to splice together old video or use things from other conflicts. I think the problem is the volume of what's happening here is so massive, and obviously the use of it as a propaganda tool. But you know, I think we have a. I don't want to do a both sides argument, but everybody is using these platforms to misinform, to create conspiracy theories, to spread hateful ideologies, and sometimes one group is doing it more than the other, and that's what's going to happen in these kind of conflicts going forward. It happened, you know, in Ukraine very quickly. The Russians were trying to create misinformation, and definitely the Ukrainians used it. If you remember the Ghost Rider or whatever, that wasn't real, or that attack where the people were supposed to have died and they didn't. You know, it's being used in some format by whatever side to create support, and people are concerned that there's more anti-Semitism on these platforms, and they should be, and that it's impacting young people or giving them changing their opinions, being used to change their opinions about who to support in the war.
I mean, people have always understood, exactly as you say, it's a very good caveat, actually, that information wars are as old as war, and it's important to remember that. And I think people get the idea that people will be posting content that is sometimes suspect and dodgy around the edges to push their argument. That we get. The thing that I think has got people alarmed about TikTok, and it may be just a point about generational ignorance, they just don't know how it works, but is the idea that the algorithm is somehow being gamed in a way that advantages one bunch of propaganda more than the other, and in a way that is more opaque because it is controlled out of China rather than in the commercial, bear pit of the US or Western market.
It sounds great. It just, there's no proof of it, right? Mm-hmm. That's the problem with a lot of this stuff around TikTok, is that there's no proof that this is happening. And TikTok has pushed back rather significantly on this, saying it is not happening. They, of course, are being, they're owned by a Chinese company, and therefore they have less, I guess people don't believe them, right? They just don't believe them. But they definitely, they will immediately become suspect because of the ownership of these companies, right? This is going to happen. That said, all the others, like look over at Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it, they're not doing any content moderation or very little. You know, they say they are, but you can see by just being on it that there's very little happening there, or that anything goes, or that, and they fired all their moderation people, so they're not doing anything. Is that better? Is that propaganda? I don't know. It just is. Yeah. It's a disastrous place to get news. And what happens is the news jumps into the real world, really, in a lot of ways. Into I would say the I don't know how the New York Times decided to write that headline, which was inaccurate about the hospital, but they did it pretty quick, and it was a decision made in speed. And because a lot of this stuff comes in speed, it creates a feeling of speed around everybody, right? And I can't imagine they might have done that in a different era. They might have taken a minute, taken a beat, and figured it out before publishing a headline like that, which they then made a correction about, but still, it's the New York Times operating at the same kind of speed, which is problematic for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, you famously said that you have, that you use TikTok on a burner phone.
I do.
So, I mean, that you're also concerned about this sort of Chinese.
That was years ago. Yes.
But you're still doing that? I mean, as a...
I don't use TikTok that much, honestly. Okay. But yes, I mean, I look at it for work, essentially. But yes, I use a burner phone because I just don't trust... I don't trust Facebook either, but I really don't trust the Communist Party, right? That's I would assume that the Communist Party is involved. And that's just me. I have no proof of this. I just assume that this is... somehow, I don't know if it's being gamed or that it's, they have more, I'm more concerned with the surveillance than anything else for myself. Mm-hmm. But other people could be concerned about the propaganda. And it makes sense that you would use this. I think the fact that we can't have any U.S., and most of these social media companies are U.S.-based, have any of them there, that's a problem. We should be able to have our social media companies there operating without any kind of strictures, as much as they have here. And that is a real, I find that to be not suspect. It just is, why are we letting that happen?
I mean, there's an obvious correlation between the people who, when you look at, you poll the United States, you see most of the older parts of the population think, you know, mm-hmm. that Israel is more right in this conflict. The younger you get, Israel is to blame. There's a direct correlation with the people who use TikTok. I mean, it does seem that way when you look at the stats. It's like,
and they change their. It might be a generational thing. Right. You're seeing that within the Republican Party. Look at Mitch McConnell wants to back Ukraine. The right wing in the country doesn't. It's an America First kind of attitude. And in the case of Palestine, it's been. You know, a lot of young people feel somehow it's been shifted into a civil rights issue, right? Mm-hmm. And so is it coming from TikTok or are they just decided that this has happened, right? This is what they think. And so that's where is the, it's not correlation necessarily because you don't actually have proof of it. And a lot of them aren't on TikTok. You know, I know a lot of kids who aren't on TikTok who think this. And where did they find out about it? I don't know. Like, they're getting information from all over the place.
Okay.
Probably the photographs and the pictures and the videos. And that has its toll eventually, even if you don't. I mean, what I think about a lot is, can you imagine if they had this much video on World War II? I mean, people would be like, wait a minute, that's a lot of people being killed or bombed or bombed out. Think about it. It would create a different point of view about war if you could see it up close and personal every 5 seconds and in very detailed and sometimes manipulated videos. And so it would change the course of war. And that's what's happened here is you can see it, not just, you know, back in the last conflict where they had the Stud Scud, do you remember that, where they were dropping bombs and you could see that. This is stuff you see the instant it happens. And so it does change people's viewpoints of war. You can see the brutality of it very quickly and therefore start to feel funny about it, right? And so you form your, I don't know. I think it's more the flood of information is the problem.
Okay. Or the
solution. Some people think it's the solution. I mean, if you, you know.
No, I've given more thought myself to what if there had been social media 80 years ago.
Yeah.
And instead of thinking that would have alerted people, for example, to the Holocaust, I now think there would have been Holocaust denial.
Right.
From the very start.
It's made up.
People would have said it's all made up and you can't believe any of it. I mean, and also the other thing people say is when you say we're seeing this one, people don't go as far back as 80 years. They look at more recent wars involving even the United States against Islamic State, for example, and say there wasn't the equivalent video there from the Islamic State side.
No, there wasn't.
But the thing I was going to ask you about in your very legitimate quest and demand for evidence, I was going to just mention this New York Times piece that got a lot of traction in which it put advanced evidence suggesting actually not just China, but it detected the hand of
Iran, Moscow,
and Tehran
behind
the spread and talked about fake bots that had been created to disseminate this video. So even if it wasn't actually wired into the TikTok machinery, there were users, state actors. What do you see of that?
Yes, they've taken them off. There's been lots of stuff being taken off of these platforms, all of them, by the way, not just TikTok, but they're removing false accounts. I mean, they're creating these false accounts in the millions, right? And like very quickly, they gin them up and then put them out and then close them down. These are covert influence operations, right? This is what they're trying to do. Listen, Iran, Russia, China have all been doing it for a long, long time, using these tools that were built largely in America, which is kind of ironic, to disrupt America. And it's not just in this war. It's over partisan thing. It's over COVID. It's over election denial. Anything they can do to create disruption is the point, right? Or doubt. And that's really the point of everything. And it's the same playbook. They did it in Ukraine, but right before the war, they were softening up the country, not just via propaganda, which is what this essentially is, but also via attacking the internet, attacking infrastructure, attacking electrical grids. We are now in a full-scale war that has to do largely with technology in terms of shutting it down. Look at shutting off internet in Gaza, shutting off the ability of people to get good information, confusing people. It's, you know, I always think, you know, that Russia really did lose the Cold War, right? But they're sort of pretty good at the cyber war, and it's cheaper. And they can do it over and over again and use our own technologies to hurt us.
And are you concerned what that means as the U.S. is approaching an election year? I mean, if
every election, yes, right. It's not the newest thing. I mean, this is what happened in the 2016 election. That's really started to gin up in the 2016 election. And then it's continued. Now, there's lots of agencies that are onto them now, too, at the same time. You have CISA here in the United States and others that are trying to teach election officials how to deal with this, including attacks on voting machines and things like that, actual physical hardware attacks. There's all kinds of people that are much more educated about how this is being done. And of course, every time they figure out whatever malware people are trying to introduce or malware methodology, they come up with a new one, right? They come up with yet another one. And then ultimately, you know, they use bots to do this, to try to upset and disturb people. And then those people get upset and disturbed. They don't really care what side they're on. They just want to create anger. And then people then jump on. It's like a digital traffic accident. Everyone stops and looks and then maybe participates. And so a lot of it is generated by these bots that gin people up. And you know, Twitter was attacked right when Elon took over with anti-Semitic and all kinds of terrible things just to test it. White supremacy, a lot of, they enjoy using these platforms to generate hate. And so a lot of it is testing to see what works and seeing how much these companies can keep to keep it out, but it all gets through, right? They attack with a flood, and that's the problem with these kind of things. And they're so inexpensive now. They're so inexpensive to do it. It's so easy to do it. And I think that's one of the other issues, is that it doesn't even have to be state actors. It's all kinds of actors. And obviously, Hamas has a very sophisticated propaganda. They went in with cameras. They were very aware of what they were doing in terms of creating terror and creating discontent as they were doing it. It was part of their strategy just as much as guns were.
No, very much. And in fact, I mean, they did live stream what they were doing.
Yep.
On social media platforms, yes. Including, I think, Facebook.
They did. And it's...
I mean, my question before was on this predicated on this assumption that somehow TikTok was out of democratic reach because it was in China, but the other ones, you could reach them through public pressure and being even shamed in the marketplace.
Yes, they seem so
what
shamed,
about that? About
Jonathan.
Something?
Well, they, I was going to say... They've never been shamed, not a day of their lives. What are you talking
right,
about?
Right, so I was going to say, what about Facebook?
I mean,
you know, and
I was
what,
just...
How, why is there no sort of sanction or even just in public opinion for what they did there with that example?
Well, we have a thing called the First Amendment here, so it's a real problem for us. We like the First Amendment quite a bit. You know, years ago, if you recall, I did an interview with Mark Zuckerberg where we had been talking about Alex Jones, who's a vile, you know, I don't, if I can say piece of shit, he's a piece of shit. He's a vile person who was violating a lot of Facebook's rules. And I said, why don't you take him off? He's violated your stated rules over and over again, right? Oddly enough, the way he got caught was through copyright infringement. He used pictures of kids he didn't have the right to use, which is ridiculous that that's what they had to go to, but the parents had to go to. But in at the time, they weren't taking him down, even though he was violating their very clearly stated rules. And so we were talking about that, and then Mark shifted the conversation, unfortunately for him, over to Holocaust deniers at the time. I don't know if you remember this, but it got a lot of attention. And I was like, oh no, please don't do this, because please don't go down here. And he did, nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And you know, he himself is Jewish, and he said, as a Jew, and I was like, oh no, don't do this. Don't say I believe that they should have the rights of other people, right? Like, please don't. And he said, Holocaust deniers very famously don't mean to lie. That's what he said. And I was like, wow, that's kind of the definition of a Holocaust denier, but okay. And I let him explain himself because I wanted people to understand his general attitude towards it. And he had, you know, it was so nonsensical. He made it up as he went along, essentially. And I think he got into quite a bit of trouble for that. But at the time, he was very much defending the rights of Holocaust deniers to post this stuff. And I said, I thought it was poisonous. I thought it was false. I thought it was hate speech. And, you know, but it was up to him and not me, right, to decide this. And that's the real problem, is the policies were made by one guy who wasn't particularly educated, honestly, at the time. 2 years later, he decided Holocaust deniers do mean to lie and took them down just because he thought it. He decided it. He got educated. It took him 2 years to come to the conclusion everybody else was already at. And so that's where we are, is this stuff doesn't have any – the government cannot intervene here in any way and tell them what to do. And there's lawsuits all over the United States right now trying to limit government's ability to even speak to tech companies about some of the dangerous content on free speech things. And they're probably going to win. The Supreme Court will probably uphold them.
But, I mean, you know him very well. And I'm just asking this from the Israeli standpoint. I mean, it's been a month since October 7th. Terrorists, we said this, we're live streaming horrific attacks on Facebook. And, you know,
they've tried to take them down. Let me be clear. It's just impossible to do so the way the platforms are created.
But, I mean, more than that, I mean, Facebook, Instagram abused by anti-Semites more often than not.
Yes.
And you kind of ask yourself, he's one of the most... I don't know, one of the 10 most influential people in the world. Why are we not hearing his voice on this at all?
Well, he's like, oh, look over TikTok. That's what he's doing. Like, oh,
and he's posting photos of his leg injury. I get that. But it's like the most horrific attack on the Jewish people since, you know, it's just, it's amazing to think.
I don't know. You know, everyone wants everybody to post, right? I get a lot of pressure, like, post something. I'm like, you know what? I'm ignorant, so I think I shall not at this moment right now. I think we'll let the experts discuss this and the people with real expertise. But I think you're right. I think he really is someone people look to. You know, every one of these companies is caught in this conundrum of any issue, this one in particular, but any issue, whether it's abortion or any controversial issue, and they're being demanded to make a statement. And you see this over in colleges here, in universities. That's where the real stuff is playing out, where a lot of big donors are demanding that the heads of colleges shut down what is essentially hate speech, and the management of these colleges have been caught flat-footed in terms of what to say. You know, they're trying to play it all ways and be very, you know, not call out Hamas or shut down these groups that are clearly using hate speech. I think Brandis threw off one of the groups who was clearly doing hate speech. But everybody's got to decide on their own what hate speech is, right? I think it's pretty obvious, you know, when you call for the support of a group of people that has been calling for the destruction of Israel, that's pretty much hate speech. I don't think that's a very difficult thing to say. But these companies really, really, companies and universities really are having a difficult time. I think they're trying to please everybody and therefore pleasing nobody, right, on some level.
Just on your, I'm very interested by it because it surprises me that it's an old-fashioned sentiment you expressed there, which is you don't make statements about everything. You think sometimes I don't know the answer. Is there any turning of the clock back to that where people didn't feel, institutions, individuals, people, that they should sound off about everything all the time?
Well, it depends on who you are. If you have huge interests there, like your company, I guess. I mean, this is me just thinking as if I was advising them. If you have interest in people there, you must say something, right? I'm going to use a different example, but when Mark Benioff at Salesforce had business in Indiana and they were passing really heinous laws against gay people, he spoke out. That was appropriate, right? Not every company should have spoken out necessarily, or maybe they should have, I guess, but most people didn't expect them to. No, I don't. I think everybody's got a platform now and everyone has an opinion, most of which opinions are uneducated, or they don't know what they're talking about, or they're being manipulated, or they're using video that either suits them or is not right. I mean, the hospital thing was just one of those things where I had some thoughts. I was like, why in the world would Israel bomb a hospital the day before? You know, just like, I'm not a stupid person, right? I was like, that seems wrong. That seems stupid. I am also cognizant that people make terrible errors in the midst of war, right? That this was, and I kept thinking, oh, this had to be a bad rocket. That's all I thought myself, but I never said it because I'm not the expert. I wasn't there. I haven't seen, you know what I mean? I didn't do the reporting there. And I think a lot of people decided to become, you know, junior detectives on things they had no, you know, I don't know anything about bombs. Let's talk to the bomb experts. Let's have reporters go in and see it. Let's have actual reporting. Let's not take the word for the Palestinian Authority, which is run by Hamas, right? Like it's an obvious, like as a reporter, you're being given information by people with a point of view and a very clear point of view. And at the same time, you know, to me, I there's an old journalism thing. If your mother says she loves you, check it, right? Like, I don't know. I feel like, and in that case, I was so surprised by the New York Times for doing that. When I saw it, I was like, oh, wow. That's not a particularly good source to base a giant headline on, is it? And even if it took a minute, I think they were under pressure to say something right away. You have to resist the urge to make a point without knowing what you're talking about. And I think they, of course, did, and they corrected themselves, and they've done a lot better job, right? That's what's good about regular media, is as many mistakes as they make, and they certainly make mistakes, they stop doing it. They correct themselves. With social media, the beat just goes on, and they make more and more. They don't even correct the mistakes. They just move on to the next mistake they make.
If we're on the issue of mistakes, let's talk about what you call the toxic waste dump, which is Twitter these days, and what you're seeing from Elon Musk, right? The ADL controversy and the rhetoric and things that are really, you know, should be pointed out as very problematic at best.
What he has a point of view.
Exactly. What can be done there? Is there anything that can be done?
No. He owns it. He can do whatever he wants. He can say whatever he wants. You know, he's, of course, tarnished his reputation almost beyond repair, I think beyond repair myself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is you're seeing him as he is, right? And or else you're seeing whatever he seems to be up to. I don't really know, and nor do I care to know. I just feel sad for humanity that this very uneducated person owns something so important in so many ways. But here we are. This is it. This is his little billboard to broadcast his typically ignorant views about everything, you know, whether it's – and usually it's cruel. It's casual cruelty. The other day, this woman who runs Libs of TikTok, whatever, I don't know. It's this group that just enjoys harassing people and doxing them. And there was a story in USA Today about how people that get attacked by this group end up getting death threats. And she, of course, was like, yay us, like, good job, my mom, whatever. And Musk was like, congratulations for doxing people. Well done. Like, it was sickening. It was sickening to watch. But, you know, if I was feeling righteous over every stupid thing he does, I'd be in a constant state of righteousness, which I really don't feel like being in. He's just stupid. That's all. He's a stupid man and that says stupid things almost continually and is very much used by propaganda organizations. You know, he's like such a mark for those people, right? He's an easy mark.
This may have to be our last question, sure. Kara, but I'm when you were talking before about the bots that gin up all this rage, mm-hmm. and even just now what you're saying about Elon Musk, I thought to myself, okay, we can't change these whole platforms. It's too big a task. But what can individuals listening to this do to insulate them, to armor themselves, insulate themselves from some of these things? How, for example, can they make sure they're not seeing those bots or ginned up by them, or they're not seeing the things that Elon Musk is putting in front of them? What's the kind of hygiene or individual things people can do to protect themselves from this tidal wave of garbage that is coming their way?
Well, turn it off. Like, I think really pretty much. I mean, these platforms are controlled by either massive companies or problematic owners, right? And so who have points of view. I think turning it off is the only – I haven't been using – there's just no – the information on Twitter is much too – it's like sifting through a toxic waste dump to find one piece of information, and that's ridiculous. I would rely on a number of news sources and make them varied, right? So you can see the different points of view that have at least some rules in place on how they do reporting. Now, that getting angry about them making mistakes, well, guess what? They're going to make mistakes. You know, when you cover a war, especially, it's lots of mistakes can be made. And then as they move to correct them, that's what I would look for. So I tend to rely on, you know, better. I typically don't trust government, but I don't not trust government, right? I want to hear what they have to say. And then we have reporters and other groups. And by the way, there's all kinds of groups now. It's not like Bellingcat, I find really helpful. The BBC Verify, CNN has a new verification thing. I think there's just, you have to have a wide diet of media to be able to take this all in. Even stuff you don't like, right? You have to look at it and hear their points of view. And you, in order to be saying like nonsense, that's just nonsense. I mean, for example, Congressman, I think it's Tlaib, wrote that ridiculous tweet about the river to the sea quote. Oh, it was meant in hope. Like, are you fucking kidding me, lady? Like, everybody understood that. And a lot of people, I thought quite correctly, including very high-ranking officials in Michigan, were like, are you kidding me, lady? That's essentially what happened. And I thought that was good. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, she said something, it was nonsensical and cruel, and people push back on it. Watch that play out. You know what I mean? Like, read what she said, but then understand what she said was just absolutely ignorant. Willfully. I don't know if it was willfully. I don't know. I don't know her intent, but it was certainly cruel to say what she did. But again, we're in the United States of America. She has a right to say it. If she wants to be a ridiculous, nonsensical person, that's fine. So I think you just have to read widely and mostly turn it off, is my feeling, and try to rely on what are considered, as you go through it, what are considered, seem to get to the story as it breaks through eventually. And understand that every single group here has an agenda, even if that's your side, right? They want to sort of, there's no truth in war. There's typically no truth in war for most of the time until it's over, and then you can assess what happened. But, you know, the problem, I would say the biggest problem is what happened on October 7th was horrific and heinous and should be remembered every single second. But what happens in the current news environment is it's what's next, right? Mm-hmm. That's the problem. Is it's like that used to stay with people. That should be staying with people the entire time, but it hasn't. You know what I mean? Like, people are like, oh yeah, but. And that's the real danger here, is the flood of information makes something so heinous just what happened yesterday, right? And that's, or 2 weeks ago or whatever it happened. Mm-hmm. And that's the danger here, is that we become so, the information just flows so quickly, we forget the other information, and then we become part of the problem in that we're constantly on this wheel of rage and anger to the next thing. It's like the movie Network or the, you know, we're just constantly enraged. And so engagement equals enragement. And therefore we forget the thing that started this, which was a heinous terrorist attack that murdered people, right? And it becomes, as horrible it is, people then replace it with the next thing, with the next thing. And what's happened after, of course, what's happening to these children, especially in Palestine, is horrific, but it just replaces it and replaces it. And we all become numb to, what is it, just a terrible conflict, right? It was started with a terrible act. And that's the problem, is the amount makes us all numb to what's really happening.
We're in total agreement on that. Yeah. Swisher, we always feel smarter talking to you.
Oh, not really.
Thank you so much for talking to us.
Don't turn it off. No,
not
be
podcasts.
Engaged.
Don't turn out. Exactly.
No,
don't turn
but
off
be
podcasts.
Engaged, but be smart about how, because it could really upset, you know, I don't know if I'm sure you're experiencing it everywhere. Everybody is on, all my friends, they're all fighting with each other. You know what I mean? Like, you see all this. Yeah. Like, everybody is in this state of anger. And that's the point of this propaganda, is to continually keep you in a state of enragement so you can't think clearly. And that's the point of spreading misleading content and real content. It's designed to make you not act. And that's the point.
Thank you, Kara.
All right.
Thank you, Kara.
All right. Thank you.
Always great to talk to Kara, and this is our second conversation with her on the podcast. I think it was really interesting to hear her analysis on what Israel, you know, how essentially we are losing this war, this sort of short form war, this social media war, and what we can do. I think it's pretty clear, a war like we haven't seen before, and this is an important part of it for sure.
No, very clarifying conversation with Kara Swisher. She's sort of across this new battlefront, really. I mean, it's a whole new area that wasn't a part of, you know, war planners' thoughts 10 years ago even, but is now absolutely part of it. Active disinformation, as well as what people are just sharing organically themselves.
So if we are on the issue of media, I just think that we should mention a report coming out of honestreporting.com. It's a pro-Israel advocacy group. The executive director is Gil Hoffman. He used to be a reporter for the Jerusalem Post. A report coming out about a Gazan freelance photographer called Hassan Aslich, that he, on his own Facebook page, was seen. We should say he works with AP, CNN. He was seen on his own Facebook page alongside Hamas terrorists breaking into Israel on October 7th. He's also photographed quite chummy, we should say, with Yihya Sinwar, the person who perpetrated this attack. The picture is from 2020 or 2021. CNN has come out and said pretty clearly that they had severed ties with him, that they also said, we have at no time found reason to doubt the journalistic accuracy of his work, but we have decided to suspend all ties with him. We should say that from the Israeli viewpoint, this just goes to show that you really can't be a journalist or a Palestinian journalist in Gaza without not only being affiliated with Hamas, but literally being very much tied to Hamas's propaganda machine and war effort. So this is a story that is kind of developing and has been developed in the last couple of hours, but it is something to look at as the other agencies also post their responses to this. But this is something that is obviously getting a lot of traction in Israel.
Yeah, and particularly, I think, striking is that photograph of him being, I think, kissed on the cheek by Sinwar, who is a high-ranking military commander in the Hamas organization. And so, yeah, as you say, it's not just that they reporters in Gaza are operating under restrictions, but what that picture tells, the story it tells, is of a kind of intimacy between Hamas leadership and journalists operating there. I thought we would close with a couple of slightly more sort of positive thoughts, only because we were talking before about Kristallnacht and Germany and the notion of those memories being evoked from the last century. And I thought it was just of note that one of the interventions in this whole conflict that has been credited, applauded for sort of making, you know, a lot of good sense and wisdom did actually come from Germany. And it's a video, a speech from the Vice Chancellor of Germany, Robert Habeck, that has sort of gone, you know, viral. It's been very widely shared around the world, in which he spoke about Germany's particular sensibility on this subject and its history, and didn't run away from it, and saying that Germany will always have a connection with and an understanding of Israel, and nothing is ever going to change that. But also, obviously, saying that it is wants to find a way out of this current crisis, and talking about conflict and how it can be resolved. It was just very humane. It was very understanding, and has been, you know, widely discussed. And so, you know, there are people can find lines in it to criticize. But just since we're talking about Germany and that the events of 85 years ago, they have an echo even now.
We'll add to that pictures that made a splash in Israel this week. Ingo Gerhardt, the German Air Force Lieutenant General, essentially commander of the Luftwaffe, coming to Israel and donating blood and saying it is his honor to do that. By the way, a very personable guy. I met him. He's a, you know, a very nice person. Just to feel, I don't want to sound flippant about this, but this time that Germany is on the right side of history is something that Israelis are, it's heartwarming to feel that for them.
Another one of those images that has been widely shared, the debate about this war, the discussion about it is reverberating all over, and obviously is seen and, you know, understood completely differently in different places. We'll keep analyzing it and talking about it, and we'll do that with each other this time next week.
We will, and we will say our thank yous to Guy Glaser and Omer Primat, and indeed, we shall meet for a special episode next week.